This is the In Self-Defense Podcast with Don West and Sean Vinson, exploring high-profile self-defense cases and identifying the lessons learned for concealed carriers.
So, hey, Don, good to see you again.
Sean, as always, nice to see you.
So, I got to ask you a question. So, you're, as most people know by now, a career criminal defense attorney.
Right, that's actually all I've ever done. I started my legal career at the public defender's office and have never prosecuted. So I understand and respect that job, and there are lots of criminal defense lawyers that used to be prosecutors, but not me.
Sure. And so I'm a litigation consultant, which is less straightforward. So I don't get to represent people. I don't try cases. I don't pick juries. I don't take depositions. But I have had a great opportunity to work with a lot of interesting lawyers on theme and theory aspects of the case. And so I've gotten into the legal mind, even though I'm not a lawyer. And I bring this all up because I want to see if you share the same problem that I have. Today I took my kids to see Spider-Man at the movie theaters.
Uh-huh.
And this movie, like so many other action type movies, I can't help but to count up all the felonies and misdemeanors that are committed throughout the course of a film, or tally up the civil liability that's being assessed while all this violence is going on. I'm just curious if this ever crossed your mind watching a film where you're like, "Oh, that's a felony. You can't do that."
You have to suspend disbelief, and I suppose suspend any notion of accountability either. Otherwise, every scene has something that would land somebody in hot water of some sort.
Right.
Either go to jail or get sued. I mean, it's the stuff that you go see, right, with your kids.
Sure. But even a classic car chase, there are at least 20 lawsuits, civil lawsuits that would come out of that, plus a multiple criminal violations, I have to feel.
Yeah, good point. I had a client one time charged with DUI. Left the roadway and hit a utility pole, bent the light pole, got the criminal charges resolved favorably, but she still got sued by the city to fix the light pole.
So not a criminal, but out of pocket.
Had to pay for it, yes.
Yeah.
Had to pay for it.
That's not unlike what self-defense shooters sometimes face.
Sure.
Right? Then that's what our podcast is about. We look at real-life self-defense shootings, things that we've seen in the news, sometimes things that we've had an opportunity to be involved with from a legal perspective, and we dissect those to look at how did these facts, as they played out, as we know them, as they were reported sometimes, contribute to what Mike Darter likes to call the fight after the fight.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you've had this first fight, this self-defense scenario. Now there's potentially a legal fight afterwards, and that legal fight could be first criminal liability and potentially civil liability.
No matter what, there's going to be a lot of cleanup of some sort.
Right.
There's going to be the literal cleanup of the scene. We've had cases where the shooting took place inside a home, and several thousand dollars spent just to clean the place up from the event that took place.
Right.
And there's the criminal process cleanup, the cost of hiring counsel and investigators and experts to sort all of that out, and then the cleanup if there's a civil claim filed. The so-called aftermath can be measured not just in legal liability, it can be measured in dollars and cents. It can be measured any emotional cost. I think if there's any one theme that runs throughout our discussions of this, is that the first fight is only the first one, and there may be at least one big one and several others to address after self-defense incident.
Yeah, I remember one of the cases that we looked at deeply was the Marcus Karma case from Missoula, Montana, and I've follow up on these cases, and the last bit of research I did on it, we know that what happened in that case is that Marcus had been robbed previously. Someone had broken into his garage. Not really broken in, he had his garage door open, so they came into the garage and took some things of value. He had been monitoring it with a baby monitor, thinking that some burglar might come back and try it again. One night after midnight, or right around midnight, he sees a shadow in his garage. He gets a shotgun and goes around out front of the garage, which was opened, and he fires in and he kills the 16-year-old foreign exchange student who is most likely trying to steal beer from his refrigerator, garage hopping. And we know that he was convicted after a trial, and he's in jail for, I believe, the rest of his life. But also, that family from all the way in Germany came to the States and sued, you know, his wife, his common-law wife, and the property and the estate, and they've got, it was undisclosed what it was, but I assume a pretty big civil settlement that ended up resolving that side of things. So we hear about the criminal stuff a lot. We don't always hear about the civil mm-hmm. stuff.
Oh, from our member standpoint, we are so aggressive so early in the case defending the members with the risk of criminal prosecution, that we get investigators and experts involved early, get lawyers involved. We have a critical response team that is dispatched to the scene immediately for a couple of reasons. One, to do the very best we can at that moment to make our members' chances the best they can be at successfully navigating the criminal investigation. But I think in hindsight, having gone through a few of these cases, we also realize that the more effort you put up front, the better the chances are of not only perhaps discouraging what might have been a close call in a criminal case, but also setting the stage not to be sued down the road.
Sure. Understanding, identifying the mitigating factors and bringing down the risk and the liability.
Sure.
Yeah, that's interesting. So one of the reasons I brought up the Marcus Karma case is that was one of three burglary / home invasion cases that we looked at. And one reason I thought it was originally interesting was because we feel that we know about the castle doctrine, right? Our home is our sanctuary. And you've said it's a special place. There's nowhere in the world where we're more justified in defending ourselves than when we're in our home.
The law recognizes situation. It. And has historically.
And has historically, right. And then here you have a guy, Marcus Karma. Someone was, in fact, trespassing, at least, in his garage. And he, because of some extraordinary circumstances, because of the fact that it was pretty well established that he was trying to lure someone back in to catch these burglars.
Yeah, I think that we really talk about that case not because we think Marcus Karma got a raw deal or was in some way unjustly prosecuted, but to point out so many mistakes that he made, so many avoidable mistakes that he made that that changed what might have been on its face protecting one's castle from mm-hmm. an intruder to what the jury and everyone else ultimately concluded was simply murder.
Right. And that's what I want to explore today, is that fine line between self-defense and murder when it comes to home invasions or burglaries that you catch in the act. Because we'll talk about a case from Cincinnati, Ohio, where we know we have this mother of five, right? She lives in a home that she owns with the five children, her estranged ex. She has a restraining order against him. She herself has a concealed carry permit, even though she wouldn't necessarily need that in her home. And he comes over, is causing a ruckus. He wants to get in the house. He eventually rips the air conditioning unit out of a window.
It's a window unit.
A window
correct?
Unit.
That's mounted and the window is closed on top of it. So if you pull the air conditioner out, you have a big hole you can crawl through.
So once he pulled that air conditioning out, he had essentially gained entry to the home, and that's when it looks like she shot him multiple times. He ended up getting taken to the hospital, survived those injuries, and her children are safe. The police looked at it for not very long at all, and even the district attorney for Cincinnati, a guy named Joe Dieters, he said afterwards that thank goodness she had a concealed carry permit and was able to defend herself and her five children. It's hard to imagine what might have happened to her or her children if she had not been able to protect herself and her family. So this is one of those scenarios where, just like Joe Dieter says, the prosecutor, thank God she was able to protect herself and her children. And it seems like here she pretty much did everything right. Right? She didn't need a concealed carry to have a gun at her home.
Let's break that down. Let's take a look at that.
She's in Ohio.
That's the prosecutor not endorsing what happened because a life was nearly lost.
Right.
But at the same time, acknowledging that she acted lawfully and that as a result, she was not going to be prosecuted. So if we break that down, we know a few things just by those limited facts that are available on this. One, that she had attempted to use the legal process, the legal system, to get some safety from this guy. A protective order is going to be issued upon application, claiming fear, threats, indicating prior incidents of violence. Likely.
You have to go before a judge and make a case for it, right?
Yeah, there's typically a temporary order issued upon the application of one of the parties, and then that's served on the other party, and there's an opportunity for the parties to go to court, explain their situation to the judge, and then the judge makes a decision whether the protective order should be issued. And apparently, based upon the information available, the judge said yes. And that order is going to require the person to stay away.
He's legally required to stay away. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she's established she's afraid of this guy. Whatever it was that convinced the judge to give the order.
Sure. Yeah, I think that is the threshold that she did before she resorted to self-help the first time there was a problem. She took the steps necessary to use the judicial system. And it didn't work. You know, that's unfortunate. Sometimes it doesn't work and there's more violence and somebody dies. In this case, fortunately, as the prosecutor suggested, she was prepared and capable to defend herself as it turned out to be necessary.
And her children.
Yeah.
Right.
So what we also know is that she herself is a law-abiding citizen because she wouldn't have a carry permit if she had a significant criminal history. So
sure.
For whatever that's worth, that she lawfully possessed the weapon, that she took the steps to be able to lawfully carry it outside the home, I think all suggests that this is a responsible person who's trying to follow the law, dealing with someone who clearly isn't. And we don't know what the relationship was like, but we know it had to have been volatile, and we knew that he was ordered to stay away because of the protective order in place, and that didn't work. And he went to the house, obviously would not be deterred to gain entry if he went so far as to pull the AC unit out of the window,
right,
and then go through. We also know it was her house. We also know the protective order made him a trespasser, if not worse, just by being on the property.
Right.
So when the prosecutor looks at the equities in this case, he doesn't have to take her word for much of anything, frankly. She's got the protective order in place.
The air conditioner
is on the ground.
Right. She's got a concealed carry permit.
Having been shot. Yeah. Now, no question that she had good reason to believe that he intended her harm. And I suspect with all of those circumstances and the factors at play, the law favored that and may very well under Ohio law presumed that her fear of serious bodily harm or death was justified.
Yeah. And one thing I want to point out here too is, unlike Marcus Karma, she doesn't run outside the house to shoot this guy. She doesn't try to engage him until he's gained access to the house.
She doesn't leave the door open and dare him to come in.
Right. Well, she doesn't go outside to meet the threat. Mm-hmm, sure. She waits there. It seems to me, and this isn't explicit in the article that we found about this, the reporting about this, but it seems to me that he was out there for a while, probably yelling before he got to the point where he was trying to rip the air conditioner out. I'm sure he was banging on the door or pounding on some windows at some point.
Sure, she didn't shoot him through the wall as he was trying to remove the air conditioner or through the window.
Yeah, it doesn't say here, but I suspect she's the type of person who would have called the police while he's out there raging in her yard. And it was only when he'd gone through the extraordinary circumstance of actually breaking into the house and now had entry that she fired and eliminated the threat.
And of course, she would have known who it was. This wasn't a stranger to her. It wasn't she couldn't write it off as a mistake or that it was someone lost, or she knew by virtue of what he did and how he was doing it in the face of the protective order and their history, judicial and otherwise, that
so you bring up whether she knew who it was. She did, obviously. That has echoes of the Ted Wafer case. We reference that a lot when we have these discussions, because that one was a real heartbreaking case. That's Ted Wafer up in Dearborn, Michigan, outside of Detroit. It's very early in the morning, around 4 o'clock in the morning. He lives alone. He's in a rough neighborhood now. And there's violent banging on the door, on the front door. It moves to the side door. It comes back around. The floorboards are shaking. The pounding's so loud. He gets his shotgun, goes to the front door during a lull in the knocking, opens it up, and he's surprised by a figure there. He doesn't know that it's a 19-year-old girl named Renisha McBride. She tries to push through the screen, it seems like, from the facts. A shot's fired from his shotgun. It blows her head off. He claimed later that it was an accidental shot. I think you and I both agree that it was probably a twitch. He was scared, he was frightened, he was startled, and he pulled the trigger, and he didn't mean to shoot her, but it seemed like she was trying to break in. That was the case they made at trial.
That may have been exactly what actually happened. That makes life really complicated, though, when you then claim self-defense, which by definition is an intentional act.
Right, it's an affirmative defense.
A justified intentional act.
You can't accidentally shoot somebody in self-defense, is what we've said before. Mm-hmm. And so the difference there, when you've got someone attempting to intrude your home, what you know about them becomes very important. If it's somebody that you've got a negative history with that you suspect will do you harm, like this woman's ex-husband, who she had a restraining order against, you're in a more justified position. If it happens to be the pest control guy, Or someone who has the mailman, mm-hmm. right? Someone who has a reason that you found suspicious for some extraordinary circumstance. You're in a much worse position, and then if you don't know who it is, then you don't know. That has an effect on the reasonableness of your fear.
Of course.
Is that true?
Of course. Sure. Yeah. One comment I wanted to make in these facts, like we've always talked about, if you just tweak one little aspect of it, you can take a legitimate self-defense shooting and turn it very quickly into a criminal act, perhaps murder. Can you imagine how emotional this whole thing must have been between these two people?
We're talking about the woman and her strange husband?
Yeah, that he is willing to do all of that in the face of the court order. So he's not to be deterred. Apparently nothing is going to stop him until eventually some bullets did. And her, they've got this relationship. It's in the worst possible shape it could be in because she had to get a protective order. My guess is that their lives together, and particularly hers, have been a living hell for a long time. Mm-hmm. She finally feels she's got the judicial process in place and she's safe. And he winds up coming over, yanking the air conditioner out, and going inside to face her with a gun. Can you imagine how much self-restraint and emotional control she must have had, because we know he didn't die on the scene.
To actually stop shooting once he had taken him down?
To actually stop shooting and not say to herself, if not out loud, you will never do this to me again, and fire that one final round.
She didn't come around and shoot him in the head while he was on the ground and finish him off.
And we've seen those cases. Cases where all of a sudden self-defense becomes murder. Well, and no prosecutor is going to defend that. The prosecutor would not let her off the hook for that if that's in fact what the facts turned out to be. You need to keep shooting until the threat is neutralized. But once the threat is neutralized and you are no longer facing that threat, you can't put one more round in for good measure.
Well, we call that every shot counts.
Sure.
Every shot fired will be judged on its own. And that first shot could be self-defense. That second shot could be self-defense. That last shot could be, and sometimes is, murder. Yeah.
Other people have said every bullet comes with a lawyer.
I was thinking about the Jairo Lee case we talked about, and that's a guy who watched his cousin get shot in the stomach right in front of him. And then he had a gun. And
the gun turned on him.
Then turned on him. And then he fired on the shooter, killed the shooter. He made the mistake of running away. But one of the things that we know really affected his trial, because the jury asked for the evidence of this, was a suggestion that last bullet was fired through his body that was laying on the ground and struck the pavement underneath him.
Yeah, they made a big deal about the forensic evidence. There was a divot in the pavement that the prosecutor wanted the jury to interpret that evidence as if it was the, what's the French term, coup de grace?
You know, Is that it?
I think that's it. The one final shot for good measure. And now, in the Lee case, if I'm not mistaken, he was convicted.
Yeah.
And then wound up with a successful appeal, but had to face the whole thing over again.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he's faced it over again yet. I'm not sure what the status of that case, which is just proof of how those things can drag on for years and years.
Well, regardless of what the final outcome is, he spent the last several years in prison trying to get it sorted out.
Yeah. So let's talk about another home invasion case. I think it's fair to call this one a home invasion case. Right, the difference between burglary and home invasion, Mr. Lawyer, Counselor, is what?
A lot of people confuse burglary with robbery. It's pretty hard to rob a house because a robbery contemplates a face-to-face encounter accompanied by a violence or threat of violence. So you can't legally rob an unoccupied house.
Okay.
You burglarize a house. A burglary could turn into a robbery.
If someone happens to be home.
Yes. And those are more often characterized as burglary than with an assault. And that's a much more serious offense than just illegal breaking and entering. A home invasion is typically considered as forcible breaking, knowing there are people inside with the intent of confronting them and robbing them or terrorizing them, doing something, knowing that you're going to be face-to-face with another human being.
Sure. So we talked about the Zach Peters case out of Oklahoma, and there we have three people dressed all in black break into the back door. They'd actually burglarized the guest house of this property in the recent past, and here they are at noon on a weekday. They break in through some glass, gain access to the house, and then are surprised to find Zach Peters is there, armed with an AR-15. That was a burglary turned into something else.
Right. That would not be viewed as a home invasion robbery to start with. I tell you what happens out there in that's often common as home invasion robberies is when there is a design to go inside and rob the people of valuables or jewelries. But you see that kind of stuff all the time when people go into drug houses. Often other gangs will go into drug houses and rob the individuals there of their drugs. The goal is to go in and control and confront and take whatever they have of value. It may very well be targeting their stash of drugs.
That's interesting. So we're looking at this case out of Wichita, where the homeowner there, he's a young guy, 18 years old, and two people that he knows, they're both 20 years old, come over in the middle of the afternoon, 2:45 p.m. on a Saturday. And according to police, they're trying to recover some property that's in dispute that the 18-year-old, the homeowner, has. They've got a bad history, these three. And these two guys are out there trying to get in the house.
So the 18-year-old is the homeowner or occupant.
Yes.
The other guys that he knows want something that they believe he has in his house. They claim is theirs. As I understand what you're saying and what I saw in the article is they went there to recover some property of some sort.
That's right.
That's never really been identified or described, other than that particular property wasn't stolen unless they thought it was stolen from them, perhaps. But
sure. I like to think of this as the O.J. Simpson scenario where he wants his trophy back. Right, I don't know what it was that they're after.
And that's a robbery. It wasn't like he broke into the place or the hotel room to steal the Heisman Trophy back. Confronted people by force and threat, and that's what made him into a robber. And that was, what did he get, 15 years? Something for that?
Yeah, well, I can't remember exactly, but he's on Twitter now, so he's out. OJ.
Another day, another conversation.
Yeah. So here you got two guys that you know that have something they want, and now they're outside your door at 2:45 p.m. on a Saturday trying to force their way in. So here's what the homeowner does. He fires through the door and kills them both. One of them shot in the back. Now, from everything we've read on this report, it looks like he was not charged for these homicides. He was later charged because he had stolen property in his house. It wasn't the property that these guys were there after, and so he's got his own legal problems, but one of them isn't apparently murder. And I bring this one up because I think we take a pretty conservative look at a lot of these cases, and our mantra is you never shoot until you absolutely have to. And usually that's when there is imminent threat of great bodily injury or death. And I think we would almost never recommend shooting people through a closed locked door. I feel like that's a recipe for some real trouble afterwards.
Yeah, I agree. That can be extremely hard to justify, although under certain circumstances, either legal or close enough, since you're protecting your home, that you wind up not being prosecuted.
Sure.
And that's typically a call that you don't want to make unless you're absolutely forced to. And you can't make that decision whether you, in fact, are justified and feel the absolute need to do that until you are right there in the middle of it and can assess your own situation, what you think the odds are against you. And in this case, he knew who these guys were. I assume he knew what they were capable of. He probably felt he knew what they intended if they were able to get inside, and may very reasonably have felt that he couldn't have protected himself adequately if they got in, that he would have been overwhelmed.
Sure, it's two against one. Maybe he believes that they're armed. Maybe they got shotguns. I don't know. But once that door is down, he's at the disadvantage, is the idea.
Mm-hmm. And we have some other things going, and that is not only did he know them, but that it seemed pretty clear that law enforcement accepted the explanation that they intended to break their way in. They were trying to force their way in, as opposed to other cases we've talked about where some crazed person or drunk person or lost person isn't necessarily trying to commit a home invasion robbery, but rather get some attention, maybe even in their mind get some help. But they raise a hell of a ruckus outside, banging on the door, the Renisha McBride case.
Yeah, she was looking for help, and her actions were interpreted as an attempt to break in, but they were actually an attempt to get help. She was confused. And
as these guys apparently were not going to stop until they got in, and there were two of them. And whether there could have been some it could have exercised better judgment or different judgment, hindsight may tell, but at this point anyway, from the initial investigation, apparently law enforcement decided it was justified. And it was his house. Let's not forget that. Like you said before, that is your sanctuary. It's a sacred place. It's highly protected. And if the law is ever going to favor your use of force,
or give you the benefit of any doubt, right?
Yeah. You remember other conversations that we've had where I use this phrase that struck me. It's a subjective forgivability.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that even if you don't do it 100% right, unless it's clear you're doing it wrong or you aren't justified, then as the homeowner who's being subjected to criminals breaking in or some other kind of threat, then you're going to be given the benefit of the doubt in your house.
So our mother of five, with all of these things that we know about her, the protective order, that she's a law-abiding citizen, she owns a house, she's got the children, she has a concealed carry permit, she waited for the air conditioner to be ripped out before she fired, all those things, anywhere where we might have had a subjective look at whether she was right or wrong, we're forgiving her because she's got everything lined up on her side.
Right.
Right. Right. This guy in Wichita, he doesn't have five kids in there and he doesn't have a restraining order against these two guys, but apparently there's enough of a documented history between them that it seems like he seems reasonable to fear them. And then we get into this other thing I want to talk to you about is a lot of self-defense statutes, and they're a little bit different in every state, right? But a lot of self-defense statutes are, you're allowed to use deadly force when there's an imminent threat of great bodily harm or death to you.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And sometimes...
That's the law in all 50 states.
Right.
Some states still require a duty to retreat. So you can't use that force unless you've exhausted a way to avoid using it safely.
Right.
And stand your ground states, you don't have to retreat first, but in nowhere can you respond with deadly force other than a threat to yourself of deadly force.
Right.
Except in very rare circumstances, and that happens to be in the house.
Right, and that's what we're leading up to. To prevent a forcible felony.
Yes.
Is often what the statute reads. And some of them I've read, like in Colorado, for example, I remember reading that includes specifically your house. Like they'll address specifically that someone breaking into your home, there's this presumption.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. We should try to make that a little more clear. Andrew Branca, that we think the world of, who wrote the book, The Law of Self-Defense, and blogs, and offers a lot of content for gun owners who want to know the law of the jurisdiction where they live and where the boundaries are. So we encourage people to take advantage of his vast knowledge to improve their own. He calls the home the highly defensible property. That's the most defendable place you can be on earth is your house. Now, what you were talking about was another aspect of self-defense that doesn't necessarily require the actual threat to you before you can use, in this instance, deadly force, and that is a lot of places, including Florida in particular, allow for the use of deadly force to prevent the commission of an aggravated felony.
Right.
And there's a list of those in most statutes. What is an aggravated felony? Robbery, murder, rape, kidnapping, those kinds of things. And you can use force to prevent someone from committing an aggravated felony in most places. And that doesn't necessarily require the specific threat, life-threatening event to you, but you do have to be right. And you have to you have to be able to perceive the circumstances correctly, and if so, you have the right to protect someone from being raped or robbed or kidnapped.
Right. Or from breaking into your house.
Yes. We talked about Florida a little bit. The Florida statute provides that not only can you use deadly force to thwart a threat, a threat against your life, but in Florida, if someone is breaking into your house, forcibly entering your house, the element of reasonable fear is presumed. Just by virtue of those circumstances at your house, they're trying to force their way in, your use of deadly force is presumed to be reasonable.
You're allowed to assume that they're going to do you harm.
Sure.
If they come in and you're there. They've yeah. broken into your house. Mm-hmm. Now, so here's where the conversation gets interesting, because we've got this great letter from a CCW Safe member. We're going to talk about it anonymously to protect the identity, but we can share the story. And the story is that this man lived on a small ranch with his wife and two children, and it's just before midnight out here on this ranch, a rural desolate area, and this guy comes up on his porch wearing nothing but blue jeans. He's a little bloodied. He's clearly been in a fight. He's either intoxicated or some otherwise out of his mind. And he starts yelling that he wants entry to the house. He's banging on the door. Over the course of 20 minutes, he tries to steal their ATV. He tries to use the swing bench on the porch as a ramrod to get into the house. He pulls up bushes and throws them at the windows. All this time, the homeowner had a pistol and a flashlight, I think, mm-hmm. out. You can see through the windows, this guy. He lets him know that if he comes in the house, he's going to shoot him. Meanwhile, his wife's on the phone with 911 in a locked room in the back of the house with the children. It's going to take 911, you know, out here in his ranch 20 minutes to get out there. And during that time, he keeps his cool. And there's one confrontation at a back door, which was a big pane of glass in it, where he was face to face with this guy. And he wrote us to let us know that he was remembering the Ted Wafer story that we wrote about. You know, don't open the door, don't go outside. This man decided that he was going to wait for this person to cross his threshold before he fired, but he was resolved to shoot him if he did, and he told him so. And as fate would have it, the police arrived in time. They take the guy down. Nobody's shot. Nobody's killed. There's no legal inquiry, at least for the homeowner, at this mm-hmm. point. And it was mm-hmm. the best possible resolution of a terrifying situation. And I would suggest that, especially at the point where maybe this guy's using a swing bench to try to ram down his front door, he may have been justified, like this guy in Wichita, who someone was trying to forcibly enter his house. I suspect the right police department and the right prosecutors can look at that and say, you know, you're all right here. But you're in gray area, or you're in a grayer area than if you were to wait for that threshold, for the window to be broken, for the air conditioning unit to be ripped out.
One of the things that Andrew Branca talks about is managing your risk. And of course, with training and experience and such, you manage your risk by being better prepared to defend yourself if and when necessary. But you also can manage your risk in the legal context. And what you're saying may in fact have been true under those circumstances. He may very well have been legally justified to fire and shoot this guy under some of the circumstances you've described. But at a very minimum, we know that his legal risk skyrocketed at that point.
Sure.
And it went from zero to something unnecessarily, and the guy had enough, he thought it through. He realized that he wasn't actually in danger. His family wasn't actually in danger at that moment. And if his level of physical risk increased. He was prepared.
Right.
But he wasn't going to do anything to make himself more vulnerable or, frankly, to increase his legal risk.
Yeah.
And
in this case, here's a guy who seems unarmed, yeah, just crazy, mm-hmm, and he had established a threshold that he was comfortable with. You talked one time about, and maybe this is an Andrew Branca thing, about buying yourself time in these critical decisions, right?
That's important to me, and I don't claim to be any kind of expert whatsoever on the tactics side, yeah, of it. It just makes sense that a lot of what goes on is trying to figure out what's going on. What does this person intend? How much of a comfort zone do I have before I have to take decisive action? And the more you do to give yourself the opportunity to assess it, I think the better decision you're going to make. And you may not have any time whatsoever, and you have to react the way you have to react.
Right.
But if you can get away a little bit and give yourself another chance to see what's going on, that's more helpful,
yeah,
than not. And if you can get completely away, then, sure, you know.
Well, and then Zach Peters, after he shot those guys, he didn't know if he had killed them, or he retreated to his room, locked the door, and called the police. So even though he knew he had people still in the house, he knew he was home alone, and he went to a safer place in the house. This guy on the ranch we talked about sent his family to a safer place in the house. And I just have to think, when I look at these cases, I see thresholds all along the way, you know? And if somebody trips an alarm and still continues to try to get in, they've crossed a threshold. Our mother of five waited for a threshold to be opened before she shot. Ted Wafer made the mistake of opening that threshold himself and forcing the conflict, right? And so I guess we might have 10 thresholds, and somewhere on the first one we might be unjustified or have what you talked about, this high legal risk. But the more thresholds that get crossed, more likely you have more time to consider your options. Your legal risk, depending on circumstances, might go down. And if you're forced at last, after having allowed those thresholds, recognize and allowed it. I mean, we talk about reasonableness in all of these shootings. That reasonableness becomes greater and greater, I think, as known thresholds are crossed.
That's an excellent point, because that's what the case will hinge on eventually. No matter what happens, the prosecutor and then ultimately the jury will have to decide, did you act reasonably under the circumstances? Another point that Andrew Branca makes, which I think is so important for people to know, and that is when you're talking about a stand your ground state, meaning that there is no legal duty to retreat. Just as a brief refresher, if there's a legal duty to retreat, that means you have to try to get away, if you can do so safely, before you use deadly force.
Before you're justified, yeah, in it, yeah.
While facing a threat of serious bodily harm or death. Stand your ground basically means is you don't have to retreat, but you can, if otherwise justified, you can meet force with force. But Andrew points out brilliantly that depending on where you are, there are certain stand your ground states that he calls hard stand your ground states, and other states that he calls soft stand your ground states. Both stand your ground, but the difference being, in a hard stand your ground state, the opportunity to retreat or the failure to retreat isn't admissible on the question of whether you acted justifiably.
So the prosecutor can't suggest that because you didn't retreat in this hard stand your ground state, that somehow reflects on your judgment or,
yes,
your fear.
And that your conduct was unreasonable. In the soft states, though, even though you had the legal right to stand your ground, the prosecutor may very well get away with arguing that, sure, he didn't legally have to get away, but he had these clear opportunities to avoid this and to get safe. And no reasonable person, no one who really was trying to defend themselves, would not have taken advantage of that. So this was a guy looking for a fight. This was a guy trying to be aggressive. And this was a guy who just missed any opportunity to avoid the confrontation. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen, when you look at the totality of these circumstances and what this person did, it's unreasonable.
And we know in the Jirel Lee case, that's the guy whose cousin was shot and he shot back, the prosecutor in that case made that argument in court that a reasonable person would have gotten out of there.
Yeah, so the jury could very well find all of the other elements of self-defense to be satisfied except the reasonableness one.
Right, so not in the Sandra Graham state, the duty to treat is removed, right? But that's just for that first threshold for whether you're justified or not. I think that if you can try to retreat safely, then you become more reasonable.
Yeah, I don't know any advisor or instructor, for that matter, any trainer that ever says don't retreat if you can. Don't avoid the confrontation if you can, because you can't control the outcome. All of a sudden, your risk has then gone up. The risk of killing somebody, the risk of being killed, the risk of going to prison for the rest of your life is just infinitely greater than if you were able to get away.
Well, I think about this rancher and what he was able to do, take everything else off the table. He was able to turn this into, for his kids, remember that night that crazy guy was banging on our door? Kept it from being, remember that night that daddy killed somebody on our porch? Justifiable or not, the trauma on his family is so different because he had that judgment and that he established those thresholds. Yeah. I think that's the lesson. You know, whenever we have these conversations, we're looking for the lessons for the concealed carrier, right? To be, everyone who's got a concealed carry permit is there because they're interested in their own, they're taking responsibility for their own protection.
Yes, the protection of themselves, the protections of their loved ones.
Of their home, right? And a lot of people who carry, I believe, responsible people will have gone through scenarios, right? They train for scenarios often of where this might happen so that they can survive it, their family will survive it. And then what we talk about are what happens after that, right? We talked about Bob O'Connor all the time and his warrior mindset and his mindset and his judgment, where if beyond just thinking about the tactical scenarios where you might need to use your weapon, thinking about we're talking about the legal scenarios here. And when you can safely, if you have the judgment and the mindset and can safely buy yourself that time and recognize the thresholds of where the threat is and when it becomes critical. And we're talking about split second decisions here, but recognizing those thresholds allows you more choices than just that one choice, the whether to pull the trigger or not. And that can be the difference between killing somebody or not, killed or not.
We know statistically it's highly, statistically unlikely, but we also know it happens. And it happens fairly frequently, but as you take that responsibility, I think the better you can train your brain to react appropriately under that high stress moment of having to make those decisions, you can also train your brain to know the boundaries better. That helps define your own conduct, and all of that together helps you avoid what could turn out to be a lethal confrontation.
We started this conversation out talking about watching movies like Spider-Man and chalking up all the felonies and misdemeanors and civil liability that happens. But I think when we talk about that mindset, if you're a concealed carrier, you end up, when you choose to carry, walking around needing to contemplate what is my liability in these situations. What's my responsibility as a carrier? What's the risk I have? And this, call it tactical awareness, if you will, add in the legal aspect of it. And it's understanding, I'm in a parking lot at night now, in a convenience store at 2 a.m. This is a place where people get shot. This is where things happen. I'm at risk and I'm armed. And right now, my my liability is high. I'm at home. I've got a security system. I have lights in my yard. I'm where I'm meant to be. My liability and my risk is low. I think these are things that we need to think about all the time when we choose to carry.
Yeah, and I think the experts would say if you're in a high-risk situation by choice, don't do it. Go someplace else. If you have to be, then of course everything else has to kick in, but you also keep yourself safe by understanding what a high-risk situation is and taking steps simply to avoid making yourself vulnerable or increasing the odds that there's going to be some problem. Yeah. You know, what's that app that Mike has, Mike Darter? He's got an app on his phone. It's, shoot, I wish I knew the name of it, Crime Something.
So the kind of crime maps that shows how at risk you are.
It'll find you, basically tell you what kind of spot you're at, what the crime rates are. Is it relatively safe or relatively dangerous?
It's interesting. You know, I like to take very long walks. And sometimes it's behind a building or someplace on a route to go somewhere. And other places I'm more comfortable than others. And there's some places where I've mapped out a long walk in advance. And I'm like, you know what? I don't think right there I'd be comfortable unless I had a gun with me. And then I stop and think, well, if I'm not comfortable there without a gun and I don't have to go there, then I just don't need to go there.
Yeah.
And that's the mindset.
That's what we're talking about, isn't it? Yeah. Thinking it through, making some decisions with the goal of being safe and reducing your risk. Don't be a victim.
Yeah. Don't be a victim. And sometimes walking away or avoiding the aggressor is how you avoid being the victim of the bigger system, the victim of the legal system.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. You know, or of your own temper. Or of a mistaken identity. All those things.
So many things that could go wrong.
I think we did it.
Okay,
Sean. Another episode in the can, Don. And a real pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks, as always. Look forward to the next time. And be good, be safe.
Be good, be safe.
Take care.